First, the man widely regarded as the godfather of artificial intelligence is worried the technology is becoming too powerful for humanity's own good. The renowned computer scientist Geoffrey Hinton quit his role at Google last year. When he resigned last May, he said he was able to speak freely about what the dangers were and that some were quite scary. In particular, around how AI could spread misinformation, upend the job market, and ultimately pose an existential risk to humanity. Dr. Hinton was an early pioneer of the neural network, a method which teaches computers to process data in a way inspired by the human brain. It's that network that morphed into AI, now considered so powerful that this week the European Union's lawmakers approved new regulations around it, while the government here has indicated it will draw up a framework. Geoffrey Hinton is with us from the United Kingdom. We're grateful for your time. Welcome.
Thank you.
At what point did you recognise AI development was getting out of hand? What things were happening?
So it was in the beginning of 2023. I was working on ways of making AI more energy efficient. And I suddenly realised that the kind of digital computers that we use for running neural nets might actually be superior to biological intelligence. There was something about them that was just better than what we have, and that was their ability to share knowledge with one another. So if 10,000 people go off and learn 10,000 different things, it's quite hard for them to share all that knowledge. Education's a painful business. But if 10,000 copies of the same neural network model running on a digital computer go off and learn 10,000 different bits of the internet, they can more or less instantly share what they all learned. So each of them can know what all of them learned. And that makes them, that's a way in which they're far superior to us.
That's an exponential growth in knowledge in terms of breadth of knowledge, right? Shared breadth of knowledge.
It's not actually exponential, but it's 10,000 times as fast they can learn. And so if you look at something like GPT-4, it knows thousands of times more than any one person. And that's because it's had thousands of times more experience than any one person could have. And they do that by having lots of different models running on different hardware, but they're all the same model. And so when one of them learns, it can share what it learned with all the others. It's a kind of hive mind.
When we talk about machine learning, could you distinguish, please, between holding general knowledge, which I think is what we've just been discussing, and reasoning, which we consider a particularly human trait?
There's not a really sharp distinction between those two. So most people, for example, think that holding knowledge consists of storing facts somehow, like you would store things in a filing cabinet. And it's not actually like that at all. Whenever you recall something, you're actually reconstructing it. And there's no sharp line between making stuff up and remembering it. And so when we recall things that happened a long time ago, we're actually making up stuff that sounds plausible to us and probably has many of the details wrong. If it happened recently, we'll probably get the details right. But it's the same process. And the process involves having knowledge that's in the connection strengths between neurons in a neural network and using that knowledge to come up with plausible strings of words that sound good to us or to the AI system. And that's what stored knowledge is. So it's not like a filing cabinet at all. It's not like a standard computer where you really do have files where you store things literally. These big neural nets don't work like that. They work much more like people.
Right now, you say AI is not more intelligent than humans, but you think it soon might be. And is this exactly what you're describing to us now?
Yes, many people now believe that in the fairly near future, it will get more intelligent than us in many different ways. So its general intelligence will just be higher than ours. And that's quite scary.
The next big question is, what are the implications? And you've talked about your concerns that at some point AI might develop what are called sub-goals. So at the moment, I presume we think we're in charge of these machines. How big a step for them to develop a sort of autonomy by...
That's happening already.
Go ahead, please.
It's happening already. Yeah, it's happening already when people try and make agents out of these big models. To get an agent to be useful, you can't micromanage it. So if you want to get to the Northern Hemisphere, for example, you make a plan, and part of that plan is a sub-goal, which is to get to an airport. And now you can work on that sub-goal without worrying about the rest of your plan. And it's the same for these big language models or big chatbots. They need to be able to create sub-goals in order to achieve things. And people are working on that now. Once they can do that, you have to be very careful about what sub-goals they actually create. They may create sub-goals that you didn't intend. That's called the alignment problem. So, for example, if without saying anything more, you told them to get rid of climate change, they might figure the best way to do that is just to get rid of people. And that's not really what you meant.
And it would be a fairly logical conclusion for a machine to come to, were there no other parameters built into its instructions. Could you give us some practical...
Exactly. If it didn't fully understand... Yeah.
...consequence. Or have ethics, or have morals, and again, humans are struggling with those concepts. But this is what machine learning is lacking while developing all the other capabilities that humans have.
Actually, some companies are trying to build moral chatbots. So there's a company called Anthropic that's trying to make sure that its chatbots understand moral principles. And that's one way of going about making them much safer.
What are some of the immediate concerns that you have about where things are at now? For example, I think more people are voting this year than, perhaps any other time in our shared modern democracies. US elections, UK elections, Australia's having an election and so forth. And so people are worried about misinformation. They're worried about deep fakes, AI-generated video, etc. Are these the immediate concerns, Geoffrey?
Those are some of the immediate concerns, and they are very urgent because they're going to happen this year. So we're getting better and better at being able to create fake images, fake videos, fake voices. And it's of great concern, particularly with the wave of right-wing populism, that people will use these to corrupt the democratic process.
What else is immediate? The impact on quite significant number of jobs, is that much closer than theoretical now? Productivity gains on the one hand, but many people losing their jobs?
That's somewhat longer term, but it looks quite likely that many routine jobs will disappear. Nobody's quite sure about this. Economists disagree. But we're facing something we've never faced before, which is things more intelligent than us. And if we get things more intelligent than us, it's very hard to make predictions about what's going to happen. But it seems likely that routine intellectual labor will go the same way as routine manual labor went when we could build machines that were stronger than us. So digging ditches is not a very good occupation to have if you have things like backhoes that are just much better at it.
So when you talk about things that are scary, we've talked generally about that with the speed and extent of machine learning as it is now. But what specific things are happening inside some of these companies that to you are scary?
So one example would be Facebook open sourcing its big models. So what that means is open sourcing is generally a very good thing. It helps a much wider group of people find bugs in programs and so on. But these things are not like normal computer programs. There's a computer program inside them that knows how to learn, but what it learns is determined by the data, and we don't really know exactly what it's going to learn. So open sourcing them is very dangerous because people like cyber criminals can take one of the open source models and fine tune it to be much better at doing things like cybercrime or phishing attacks. And really what's limiting cyber criminals at present is they can't afford hundreds of millions of dollars to train a really big model. Like people like OpenAI and Google and Facebook and Microsoft can afford that. If we open source the models, they don't need to train a model from scratch. They can just fine tune it to be good at cybercrime. And that's very scary. I strongly believe we shouldn't be open sourcing the big models, but there's controversy there. So my friend Yann LeCun thinks it's a great thing to open source them. He's very optimistic and he thinks the good guys will always be able to defeat the bad guys.
This is imminent. This isn't a problem we have to address collectively within 5 years or 10 years. This is imminent, Geoffrey.
Some things are imminent, some things are longer term. Like the existential threat, we may have 5 or 10 years to address it. That's the threat of these things actually taking over and taking control away from us. But things like corrupting elections, we have to do things right away, yes.
What can we do?
It's technically difficult, but we have to work towards having it be very clear whether a video or an image or a voice is AI generated or real. So we do that with things like money. It's perfectly okay to make fake money as long as you make it clear that it's fake. So in Monopoly, you have fake money that looks nothing like real money. But you can actually make things that look a bit like real money. Artists sometimes do it. And that's perfectly legal as long as it's clear that it's fake. And what we really need is a technology for making clear that fakes are fake and very strong laws that say if you try and pass off something that's fake as real, that's a serious crime. That's what we do with currency. And with currency, even if you didn't make it yourself, if you pass on currency you know to be fake, that's a very serious crime.
Could that be included in election campaigns that would see candidates' campaigns that falsify imagery this way held accountable for it? I'm sure the candidate would find a way to be arm's length, as they do with fundraising, right? But could that be introduced so that there are implications of significant scale? Because this is happening right now, Geoffrey.
Right. If you think about a candidate, suppose their campaign organisation starts printing fake money and passing it off as real, I think that would reflect back on the candidate. And we need laws of that degree of strictness in order to protect democracy.
The bad actors can be cyber criminals. They could also be potentially heads of state, couldn't they, Geoffrey? Wherever there is a potential abuse of power, this technology is going to elevate that capacity.
That's certainly true. And it would be very nice to insist that fake videos be marked as fake, but I don't think it's going to happen, for example, in the United States, not anytime soon, because one of the main political parties there has sort of dedicated itself to perpetrating something they know to be a lie. They're perpetrating the idea Trump won the last election. So when a political party is dedicated to fake news, it's very hard to insist that things be marked as fake.
Let's talk about the existential threat. The point at which, I guess, digital intelligence could overtake biological intelligence, or at least get to a scale where it becomes a threat to us. How might this unfold, Geoffrey?
So I mentioned one way it might unfold, which is once it's smarter than us, we might give it goals and it might achieve those in ways we didn't expect, which are harmful to us. It's also possible that, so for example, one very good sub-goal for almost anything you have to do is to get more control. Because if you have more control, you can get more done. Politicians know that. They often start off wanting to do good things, and pretty soon their main aim is just to get control. Now, all of us do that. So for example, I was in a seminar and I saw a little spot of light on the ceiling. And then I realized it was a reflection off my watch. And the first thing I wanted to do was figure out how I should move my arm to get it to move in various directions. We have a kind of inbuilt desire to get control of things. And if they want to get control, they'll be able to get it because they'll be smarter than us. And we may end up as a sort of sideshow. Even if they're doing things to help us, they're our assistants officially, they might actually be in charge of everything.
Without intent, they'll do harm. And we haven't got anywhere near talking about consciousness yet, and we could talk for the rest of the day about what it is. But I have a fairly good idea that I'm sitting here and a fairly good idea that I'm talking to you. So let's use that as a very simple measure of consciousness.
Well, they can have that too. They can know where they are and they can know who they're talking to. So I don't think you can use that as a measure of consciousness.
What would you use? What would you use as a measure of consciousness? What makes us human as opposed to them?
Ah, well, maybe there isn't anything. So let's take the following example. Let's not talk about consciousness because that involves sort of reflexive self-awareness. Let's talk about subjective experience. So most people have an idea that there's a kind of inner theatre which they experience, and only they can see what's in the inner theatre. So, for example, when I say I see little pink elephants floating in front of me, perhaps because I drank too much last night, most people think that means in my inner theatre there's little pink elephants, although it's not clear what they're made of. But there's a different way to understand that, which I think is a far more correct way to understand that, which is when I say I have the subjective experience of little pink elephants, what I'm really saying is what my perceptual system is telling me would be correct if there were little pink elephants out there. And that's very different from the idea of an inner theatre. What a subjective experience is a description of the world, how the world would have to be for our perceptual apparatus, which is currently malfunctioning, to actually be working right. And that's a way of me conveying to you what my perceptual system's telling me. And chatbots can have that too. So let's suppose we have a multimodal chatbot that has a camera and it has an arm and it, obviously it can talk, and we've trained it up so it can see things and talk about them, which they can already do. And then I put a prism in front of its lens and I put an object straight in front of it and I say, point at the object. And because the prism bent the light rays, it'll point off to one side. And I say, no, no, that's not where the object is. It's straight in front of you. I put a prism in front of your lens. And the chatbot says, oh, I see. I had the subjective experience that the object was off to one side, but actually it's straight in front of me. Now, if the chatbot says that, I think it will be using the words subjective experience in exactly the way that people use them. So I think chatbots can have subjective experiences in that sense. I just think people misunderstand what a subjective experience is. They have this crazy notion that there's sort of some funny internal stuff called consciousness. That's not how our language works.
So are we at the point where we have created another species, non-biological, non-organic, but we have created another species?
I think that's a very good way to put it.
And
of course, if this had come from outer space, we'd be terrified. But because we made it ourselves and it speaks good English, I don't think we're scared enough.
What it doesn't have, and this is what frightens us, even though we've brought our own perils to the planet, is the kind of, we presume, the kind of feelings, ethics, morals, emotions, the human inclination towards being a member of a group, much as we fail. That's what we perceive AI currently not having. Could it develop it? And is that right at the heart of what we're discussing, Geoffrey, with the work that's now going on, largely unregulated, largely unknown to most of us?
Yes, it's my belief that it could. So, for example, people have done experiments where they take chatbots versus doctors explaining things to patients. And the patients often find the chatbots more empathetic than the doctors. Now, most people say, well, but they don't have real empathy. But if people find them empathetic, then maybe they do. The one thing to remember about these things is they're not like normal computer programs. They're not lines of code. They're connection strengths in a neural network that were learned from massive amounts of data. And we don't exactly know how they work inside. We have some idea. And we have to remember they're very like us, and our attempts to say people are special and these things are just computers may well fail.
I don't want to ask you how optimistic or pessimistic you are about how this ends, but I would like to ask you what you believe needs to happen now to avert the point where humanity finds itself subjugated to something it created. What would be your message to everybody now?
So one message is that smart young researchers should be working on the alignment problem. They should be working on figuring out how to prevent these things doing things we don't want. Some people are very optimistic that it'll just happen, like Yannicka. Other people, like me, are somewhat pessimistic. But we don't know enough about the science of it. So that's one urgent thing to do. There should be a lot of research going into the science of it, comparable amount of research to going in as is going into making them better. Another thing we should do is try and insist that governments have legislation to mark fake videos and fake voices and fake images as fake. We should, if possible, have something like Geneva Conventions for battle robots. I think battle robots are going to be very nasty, and we probably won't get things like Geneva Conventions, which should work for chemical weapons fairly well. We won't get those until after we've seen how nasty they are. At present, all of the major defense departments are working on things like battle robots. The US, so far as I can tell, would like to have half of its soldiers be battle robots by 2030. So we need legislation to limit the harm they can do, but we won't get that until we've had something very nasty happen.
Geoffrey, thank you so much. Much appreciated. Geoffrey Hinton, the renowned computer scientist, he quit Google last year and is now free to speak freely about his concerns about where AI has got to and where it is going, if there is not the kind of intervention he's just been discussing with us.